Welcome, everyone, to the Iconoclast Roundtable. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Sarah Haboubi, and around the table we've got an extraordinary group of people who have behaved in an extraordinary way during extraordinary times. And you've all put your heads above the parapet in one way or another, and whether that was by design or by accident, I think we're going to find out in a minute. So around the table we have Eddie Hobbs, who is a financial writer and a well-known figure from mainstream media, from, well, even I know you, and I'm not even Irish, so you're definitely extremely well known to so many people. We have Ivor Cummins, who is a biochemical engineer and a corporate complex problem solver, and many people would know him from his amazing podcast that he's been doing, well, for many years, but mainly more so in the last year. We've got Barrister at Law and the founder of the Irish Council for Human Rights, Tracy O'Mahony. We have Dr. Anne McCluskey from Derry, who is a GP and was also the co-deputy of AINTU, which was a all-Ireland political party up until last year, I believe. We also have another GP, Dr. Pat Morrissey, who's from Limerick, and we have Professor Dolores Cahill, who molecular biology and immunology, and if I was actually to list her entire resume, I think we'd be here all day, actually. So you're all very, very welcome, and I'm very, very honoured to be here and to be able to talk to you all today. It really is it's quite amazing to have you all here. So I'd like to just start by asking you a question, which is this. I want you to just cast your minds back to the 1st of March 2020. I'm going to do a little bit of time travelling, and just explain, where were you in your lives at that point in terms of professionally, personally, you know, as much as obviously you'd like to just to sort of give us a little bit of a context as to where you were before all this started. And then what was it that made you think maybe differently from the majority of people? Was there something that happened that made you sit up and take notice in a different way? So where were you, and was there something that made you think, you know what, something's not quite right here? So we're going to start with you, Eddie, if that's okay.
Well, I had been watching what was going on in Wuhan from an economic perspective for some weeks. And I remember I was out at dinner actually with a couple of friends of mine in Cork City, just a three couples. And we just got home. It was 11 o'clock and the news came through that Lombardy was in lockdown. And I remember being quite shocked by that and saying, these were financial people as well, and said, look, the global stock market is going to collapse next week. Because this is very, very significant, and people were, you know, even then people were not accepting of that. And of course that's what happened. So the world stock market did fall very dramatically. We were so focused on the disease at that stage, nobody was really watching what was happening on the economic side. But it was quite some time before, up to $21 trillion of stimulus was created to try and deal with the collapse. But stock markets fell between 40 and 60% in a matter of days. All assets were being sold. Gold was being sold. Bonds were being sold. It was really terrifying for people who were watching this on a daily basis. But everybody was focusing on Italy and the disease and not really what was happening in the real world outside it. And that, by the way, hasn't changed.
In terms of the focus?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what was happening in your life at that time? Like, obviously, you know, in terms of the change from before the lockdowns?
Well, financial services, I mean, all the data shows the financial services hasn't done too bad. There was a loss of about 1% of its value last year. But really, I mean, the arts and entertainment and hotels and restaurants are down about 50%. The public sector is flat. Nobody's lost their jobs there. Mm-hmm. The pharma area, FDI, telecoms, all done okay. And the really the kind of low paid end of the private sector, again for the second time in my life, the last one being the global financial crisis, has been carrying the cost and has been devastated.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Eddie. Ivor, what was going on for you, and what was your, you know, warning bell?
Well, I've been around 8 years working in metabolic health, traveling all around the world, prevention of heart disease, diabetes type 2, etc. So I have a huge network of medical people and experts. So to be quite honest, I saw this thing coming. I wanted to see the data because I'm a data guy, problem solver. And I saw the Diamond Princess and I did some quick calculations and I figured this is going to be like a severe flu and it's going to be heavily stacked towards the aged and the frail, which is sad. But the talk and the rhetoric that's going around, it's not going to be like they're saying. And my wife even went to get masks and stuff, and I said, why? And explained the numbers and the initial Chinese data. You can see the 10x or 10 times risk if you have cardiovascular disease, COPD, or all these metabolic insulin resistant conditions, or if you're very aged. So I was just saying, everyone's losing the run of themselves. Now, when Italy fell, then I realized, okay, they're really losing the run of themselves, because I was also familiar that, you know, the spread of respiratory viruses is not as simple as is being said. You know, that there's many modes of travel, and locking down people and communities is not going to have as much of an impact as they perceive. But I did say to my wife, you know, they're going to go through this. It's going to come through the winter. It's going to come into the summer. It's a coronavirus, which is sharply seasonal. And it's just going to go through a curve like flu. And then in a month or two, it'll open up again and people will get past it. And of course, that never happened. So I got really interested in April then, when the Irish government were talking about 4 or 5 month exit plans. And I was thinking like 4 or 5 weeks max. Yeah. And then I increasingly realized that there was something going on that was much more than the real de facto, the actual impact of SARS-CoV-2 did not justify anything that was going on anymore. So, yeah.
You mentioned the Diamond Princess. So for people who don't know, you know, what that is, so this was a cruise ship that was marooned off. Where was it again?
Oh, I remember there were Japanese people on board, all nationalities. Can't remember where, but there was 3,700 people, and I think around 2,000 odd were staff, and then the rest were quite an aged profile. And the numbers that came out of that, rough and tough, 7 died. Now, a few died later. All the people who died were in their 80s. And well up there. And if you looked at the whole ship, it's a Petri ship, I called it at the time. It was basically a hyper transmission scenario. They were all cooped up with shared ventilation, all in one crucible. And I knew that that would show what would happen to the world over a long time. And sure enough, there was around 0.1 or 0.15% mortality you could predict, or 1,500 per million over the long term. And that's exactly where we are. Sweden is around, if you truly look at all-cause mortality in Sweden for 2 full waves of the epidemic, they're around 3,000 in 10 million, or 300 per million people, again, aged. Europe is around 800 per million people, or 0.08%. So on average across Europe, and even America is 1,300 per million, 0.13%, but you can see they're all slowly going towards Diamond Princess. So we had the answer back in March.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was Michael Levitt as well who came out with the Nobel Prize winner, who also said this right at the beginning as well. So yeah, he's kind of been, you know, vindicated and proved right in terms of the numbers.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say, and I interviewed him again recently, he's in our new movie, but I interviewed him again on the mistakes he made, and he underestimated primarily US mortality because he missed out on the seasonal effect. And he actually called out that I had actually contacted him and said, Michael, be careful with the seasonal effect, because Northeast America has behaved like Europe, but Southern America is going to behave more like Brazil. And he underestimated pretty strongly. But in terms of overall correctness, Michael Levitt is 80-20 on the money. And sadly, many of our experts in the media are around 80-20 incorrect on many aspects of this.
And he, you know, he was able to also admit when he got something wrong, which is really, really important too. So Tracy, what about you? What was your red flag or your warning bell? What was it that happened that made you sit up and take notice?
The 20th of March 2020, when they passed the Health Preservation Act through the Dáil inside 48 hours. So I think for me, around the start of March, I was quite cautious. I think I was the same as everybody else. I was watching the people walking down the streets in China falling down dead. I was concerned in the same way that most people were, that there was a potential for that to happen here. I worked from home. I socially distanced. I didn't wear masks because I didn't agree with the science around the masks. but I was being very, very cautious. I also have an immune condition from having Lyme disease for a number of years. So I was very concerned for myself. I was very concerned for my own safety. So I took everything very, very seriously at the start, around the start of March. When I saw the legislation come out, though, on the 20th of March, it made me really, really uncomfortable. I thought genuinely for me, even if there was a situation where people, and, you know, it might sound harsh to say it, but even if there were a situation where people were walking down the street and they were falling down dead, I still wasn't happy with the legislation. I still wasn't happy with the type of control that the government were being given. I wasn't happy with the type of regulations the legislation said they could put into place, that there would be no scrutiny, that the Oireachtas was giving the Minister for Health the authority to literally govern our lives, that there was no cut-off point. Well, sorry, when I say there was no cut-off point for one part of the legislation, there was a cut-off point, sunset clause, which was in place until the 9th of November 2020, which we obviously know was extended because the Health Preservation Act is still in place and still running. But the 20th of March was the date for me when I saw the legislation pass through so quickly. And as well as that, if you actually try to look on the Oireachtas website, you cannot find the votes. You cannot find how each TD voted. I don't know which TDs within the Dáil, the 160 TDs, I don't know how any of them voted. That makes me very, very uncomfortable.
And that must be a really unusual situation then, that you can't see which way they voted.
It is. And I suppose something else that we did recently was we looked back over the last 7 months at all the different debates that happened through the Dáil around COVID-19 legislation. I can find every other debate, I can find every other vote, but I can't find that vote. Maybe I'm not looking well enough, maybe it is there somewhere, but I can't find it. And that makes me very uncomfortable. But the red flag for me was that legislation when it was passed through on the 20th of March.
And it was pushed through within
48 hours.
And how big a document?
Oh, it's very short. It's so the Health Act 1947, the Health Preservation Act has amended the Health Act 1947 by including a new section 31A. It's only maybe, I would say maybe 30 pages long, but it's not really that document that creates all of the problems, because that document just allows the Minister for Health to create regulations to slow or minimise or stop the spread of COVID-19. So it's the power that Act created. It empowered the Minister for Health to create all of these regulations. And since that time, since the 20th of March, I believe they've created, drafted, enacted over 100 regulations. And it's something that you see, they'd enact a regulation maybe on a Monday, they'd realise on a Wednesday they made make a mistake, they'd amend it on the Thursday. You know, it goes through Iris Ifigul, which is the government gazette, where it has to be published. It legally has to be published within that gazette, you know, within a number of days. But it wouldn't actually be published within that gazette for several days after it's actually enacted. So there are so many things from a scrutiny point of view. There's no scrutiny, obviously, within the Dáil because of the regulations. The only scrutiny is around the primary act. But as well as that, when the regulations are enacted, for the majority of people, they don't even know they're in place. It's very difficult to find them. They're not on the Irish Statute Book website. They're actually on a separate gov.ie site for COVID statutory instruments. So there's an awful lot around it that's just, it's very, very uncomfortable.
It's all quite hidden, isn't it, really, in terms of, you know, mainstream media is not reporting on these either. So it's quite hard, as you said, for an ordinary person to actually know what's happening.
I'll tell you, Oran Doyle, who is a lecturer, I think, in Trinity, who recently came out with a report, it was only through a tweet that he posted, I think, yesterday, that I found out that mass is now actually illegal because of a new statutory instrument that was published a couple of days ago. I think it's 178 of 2021. So it was only through a tweet that I actually found that out, because these statutory instruments, they're so great in number that it's very, very difficult to keep up with them. And some of them they're extremely complicated as well. So that's how I found out about that, that mass is now illegal.
And just for viewers, so we're clear, statutory instruments are uttered by the minister. They bypass the Dáil, isn't that correct?
Yes. So the Dáil gave the Minister for Health the power to implement statutory instruments, regulations. So provided the statutory instrument is in relation to, like, the primary act sets out a number of things that they can do to slow or stop the spread of COVID-19. And then the Minister for Health basically has unlimited power in how he does that.
This is the Minister for Health who was elected in the 15th count in his constituency. To have that phenomenal power is really something else, isn't it? It's chilling.
And Anne, obviously, you know, you have had a political career as well as being a GP. So what about for you?
I wouldn't call it a career now. So, yeah, I mean, I've worked as a GP in Derry. I qualified here in Dublin.
And I worked as a GP. I trained in paediatrics first of all, and then moved into general practice. And I worked as a GP, but I retired to kind of early retirement to go into politics. I've always been involved in the peripheries of Republican politics at home and community activism. You know, I'd been involved in a lot of sort of community and voluntary groups and stuff like that. So I've always kind of been interested in that whole facet. And so I was elected as a councillor in Derry and Strabane District Council in 2019. And I was deputy leader of an all-Ireland political party called AIM2, which is still going strong. They're not past tense, but I'm afraid I had to part company with them.
And so, what was the reason for that? Was that around?
Well, you were talking actually about, on for me, the moment, the light bulb moment, was when Derry and Strabane District Council were having a meeting in the mayor's parlour. We were all pushed in, and it was, would we cancel St. Patrick's Day? This was maybe a week before St. Patrick's Day, and we had to know. And I was arguing very strongly because, again, I was aware of the data. I knew about the Diamond Princess. I knew what the case fatality rate was of this. And I knew that there was, to cancel stuff was not necessary. And, you know, obviously, you know, we were still trying to find our feet and figure out, but I was arguing. So many votes in council were 39-1 against, you couldn't make it up. But anyway, so then, you know, obviously the lockdown happened and St. Patrick's Day was cancelled, as was Easter, as was everything else. And I did say in the summer that if they locked my city down again on the basis of PCR tests, whenever it was obvious that whatever happened was over, I said if they locked it down, I would resign. So they did, and I did, and the rest is history. But I then went back to work as a doctor. Not that I'd ever, never really, you never stop being a doctor, I don't think, but I went back to frontline work, I suppose. I worked in Western Urgent Care, which is our out-of-hours centre, and I did one shift in the local hospital's COVID centre. And while I was hearing on the mainstream media that the place wasn't, I quote, like a war zone, including, you know, that this was the narrative, and the shift that I only did one shift in the COVID centre, there were 15 staff, three doctors, 8 or 9 nurses and admin staff. And in a 4-hour shift, we saw 3 patients, none of whom should have been there. One had bought a SATS monitor off the internet and didn't know how to work it. Another person had a serious, you couldn't make it up. And the doctors who were working there regularly were telling me this was absolutely typical. Now, this was in the middle of April. They were on Netflix, on their phone, bringing in knitting, reading books. A colleague of mine said he'd never done more reading than he had. You know, so that it was just the split between the reality and you know what we were hearing. And then in Western Urgent Care, what was happening we were seeing, doctors were afraid to see patients. And I've always been a bit contrarian. I was going, hold on a second, these are people in need of help. I saw a 15-year-old who almost died from undiagnosed diabetes, who had phone calls with 3 or 4 doctors earlier that week and just wasn't picked up. And I got into trouble for bringing him because his symptoms were non-specific and it wasn't an emergency and all this nonsense. And since then, what I've seen is not people gasping with respiratory diseases, but people who have been utterly abandoned by their healthcare systems. And it's deeply troubling. And so, yeah, I suppose since then, I made a decision that, true to form, I was going to fight. So here we are.
And in terms of the hospitals now, you know, so over the last year, you know, how's that just continued to be the case, that they've been very quiet in that respect?
And more, I mean, you can see that there have been quite a few whistleblowers, a lot of nurses and quite a lot of, you know, nurses and ancillary staff. Unfortunately, the censorship and the threat to people's livelihoods it's something I have never experienced before. I mean, I remember marching against censorship whenever it was, what you call the Section 31 way back in the day. I remember, you know, and it's the people who were most against censorship were now seem to be quite relaxed with the fact that any dissenting voice is shut down, and just these ad hominem attacks. They don't, and Ivor, you'll recognise, they never talk about what you're saying. It's just that you're a crazy person.
Yeah, there's a character assassination.
So all those crazy people just have to find a voice somewhere and take the ad hominem attack.
It's great to have your voice here. Thank you very much. And Pat, you're a GP from Limerick.
Yes.
And you have Similar story to Anne's, or
similar,
what's
your... I didn't have the opportunity to consider retirement or politics. So I was had the nose to the grindstone, working in my own practice, the doctor working in the practice, and the whole period is a blur, but I do remember Ivor's reminded me of this, you know, the story of the Diamond Princess, Michael Levitt. I found Ivor online and found that a fantastic source of information, and it kept me up to speed at the time. But I was never one to just follow the rules. I like to do my own research into things, and I looked into the therapeutic side of things, because I felt that this is a great opportunity. If we're, frontline doctors, if people are going to be coming into me sick, what can I do for them? And I found myself translating South Korean documents and Chinese documents and talking about chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and these sort of things. And there was no talk about it on our side at all. And then we get the circular saying that these medicines are not to be used. And, it just seems so bizarre. And the Diamond Princess, as Ivor had said as well, the you could see, as he said, this petri dish, this perfect environment for transmission, yet only a handful of people died, and they were all cruisers. They were older, of an older age cohort, so I thought that was very reassuring. But it didn't make any sense that something that has the characteristics of a common cold or influenza, that's a respiratory virus, that we should be doing something completely different from what we've done for eons, locking down society. It just didn't make any sense. It's not transmitted like Ebola. It's not as lethal as Ebola. We've had more serious public health issues in the past, and I spoke about TB at one stage, and that killed a lot more people at much younger ages than this thing does. The age predilection with COVID is very, very much slanted towards the older age category, and I still think the median age is 83. Yes, I could see from the media that they were trotting out the tough cases, the hard cases, why this is not representative of what we're seeing. And I like Anne mentioned, my colleagues, a lot of them unfortunately were retreating behind telephones and away from the front lines, and I felt like this is an opportunity to do something. So I helped set up the first COVID hub in the Midwest, in South Hill and the southern environs at Limerick City, and I had a lot of resistance to that, and I was able to recruit a lot of young doctors who were willing to put their shoulder to the wheel as well. But again, like Anne, saw very little pathology coming in, and what you did see was often not COVID related, but people that did need to be seen, that we needed to lay on the hands, we needed to get our stethoscopes out, we needed to see these patients, and dealing with these people over the phone was not appropriate. And COVID is real, and I did see people who were sick, and I appreciate in the hospitals they saw another aspect of COVID that I wouldn't see in general practice. But over a year of this now, I've seen a lot of COVID. I've treated sick COVID patients, and I think my perspective on it is fairly well informed from a GP's perspective.
What was the advice that was given to doctors around how to treat people who did have symptoms? What was the general sort of protocol?
It was kind of do nothing, and if you can't breathe, go to hospital. It was insane.
Yeah, yeah.
When did we ever treat anything like that before? It was just a whole...
And stay at home.
Yeah.
Do nothing and stay at home, and if you gasp, we'll maybe think about getting you some treatment.
Yeah, there's a Dr. Tyson in California, and he's quite involved with the American Frontline Doctors. Simone Gold is another one of those doctors. But he made the analogy, if you had a patient with pneumonia that came into you and you had antibiotics in the drawer, saying to the patient, sorry, Jim, there's nothing I can do for you, but if your lips start going blue, then call the ambulance and maybe they'll put you on a ventilator. And it made no sense to me when I could see from the papers that were generated that there were therapeutics there that could bring some benefit. I wasn't sure how much benefit until I started using them.
And what did you see then once you did start using them?
They work, but you just have to use them early. And then the whole vitamin D thing, you know, it's as if people's immune systems don't exist anymore. They don't want to acknowledge the existence of the immune system.
Conspiracy theory.
Yeah. So vitamin D is fantastic. And the data behind vitamin D. And there's actually a very interesting study, I don't know who the author is, but an Irish study about the variation in vitamin D status in European populations. And you can correlate that with the severity of disease.
Wasn't that out in April?
It was out even before.
But I think there was a specific study that was showing, from what I can remember,
there's a newly released one, and I believe there was a panel in the Oireachtas, you know, politicians, it was reviewed. But yeah, it's the first very positive Irish document that's released. But I think you'll find the media are not interested in it too much.
Well, it's not just the media. I mean, by the sounds of it, in terms of the medical professionals, you know, what advice and what protocols you were, you know, recommended to use.
I disagree. I think it is the media.
Not just the media.
Oh, yeah, right. Right. But, I mean, I've been in the media for 30 years, right? In Ireland, it's really run by a very small number of people. The media in Ireland has been hollowed out over the last 10 years because of the advent of technology and big technology companies. That's where the advertising revenues are going. So salaries have been cut. The whole way newspapers are put together has changed. Journalists are under savage pressure and editors are putting out stuff on fumes. Mm. And along comes COVID-19. At the back end of all of that, the biggest contributor to the media is the state. The HSE and NPHET are the same organisation. So they are dependent on the source of income just to keep the show on the road. RTE basically walked away from journalism in March 2020. Presenters were told what to do. There was leaks to the Irish Times the night before from the establishment, the civil service, about what the politicians were considering to announce the next day. That would then come out in the Irish Times as a speculative piece, when in point of fact it was policy 24 hours in advance. And people plugged in and listened to this stuff day in, day out for 12 months. So as a consequence of that, I just want to cut to the chase here, if you don't mind me saying it, right? As a consequence of that, the moderate Irish public have been radicalised without realising it. They think that they're the moderates. Mm-hmm. They're the radicalised people because they're listening to this disinformation and propaganda coming out, which is why all of the type of information we could talk about ad nauseum here, all of the evidence is not being discussed because the Irish Fourth Estate is not dealing with it. And unfortunately, when you get power, states become very powerful at a time of war, which is what we've got against the virus. And unfortunately, the way you curtail it is by having a strong media. But we had the complete opposite dynamic here. And that's why this is not being discussed. And it's why it's put out to the periphery. And it's why Ireland is producing the most conservative approach in Europe to handling the pandemic. And why again, and it's a bugbear of mine, why again the most vulnerable, lowest paid part of the private sector is getting it in the neck. And that's what's happening for the second time in the last 13 or 14 years. That's what we're looking at.
Okay. Well, so, and Dolores, what about you? What was going on for you when this all started, and what was your red flag? What was happening for you?
I suppose you were saying March 2020, right? So I suppose I would have been aware since about 1997 about the cycles of unnecessary pandemics, but I really followed closely SARS in 2002, 2003. And so it was well known, and there were clinical trials in 2003 and 2005 that foreign influenza-like illness caused by SARS, a coronavirus, that hydroxychloroquine and vitamin D, C and zinc were actually very effective, and there's now more than 20 regulatory approved, some of the safest drugs in the world.
Sorry, you're saying that in 2003 they knew this?
So there was clinical trial on chloroquine in 2002 to show that it would be very effective and was very effective for SARS back in 2002, 2003. Right. And then there was a full clinical trial in 2005 to show that hydroxychloroquine, which is one of the safest drugs in the world, it's on the World Health Organization Essential Medicines of the World, and it's been approved for 65 years, and it can be given to pregnant and breastfeeding women. And so it's one of the safest drugs. And I suppose one of the questions, there are preventions and treatments, so not one person needs to die if they're given properly, including vitamin D that has a Nobel Prize, and ivermectin that has a Nobel Prize. So really, I would have known this for 20 years. I know exactly. So there was a Forbes article a few years after the SARS in 2002, 2003, showing that the media exaggeration was entirely inappropriate and the economic losses in businesses were entirely unnecessary, and that it was a combination of the World Health Organization through a media coordinated communications across the world that was exaggerating the risk and the threat of illness, and then Nobel Prize winning, you know, medicines were not made available, and that essentially every single one of those deaths were not necessary. There was only, well, not only, but there were 774 deaths back in the flu season in the world from 2002 to 2003. So it's entirely, it is a preventable illness, and just like Pat said, it would be like not giving antibiotics to people who have pneumonia and then locking down the world on a disease that is entirely preventable. For 1 year of the lockdown in Ireland, you have 5 million years of life lost. For 1 year in the UK, it's 65 million years of life. So it means everyone born in Ireland on average will live 1 year less. And so that is huge harm versus, you know, maybe we have 200 people that died from COVID-19, but if they had been given prevention and treatment. So the question is, why is prevention and treatment, Nobel Prize winning, not being given? Because there's no need for the lockdown. And what I'm saying is the truth will come out eventually, and everybody here are just saying things that are true. And this is, and what we need to do, and part of the World Freedom Alliance and the World Doctors Alliance is, and you know, I'm leading in the world the PCR sequencing consortium, right, with Jack Lloyds-Weber and Professor Shin Lee in Yale University, is that we are ready now for the next pandemic. So if they come out again and say 4,000 people have died from an infectious agent, we just say, okay, we are the world consortium. We will sequence those 4,000 whatever PCR samples. And how we will end the lockdown, and people should have great hope, is that we are setting up a mechanism in Testgate to sequence the so-called positive and negative PCRs. And the law only applies to SARS-CoV-2. So if we sequence it and they are, you know, some primer, dimer, false positives, or human DNA or influenza or adenovirus, and hardly anyone is SARS-CoV-2, which I expect they would not be, then the lawful basis, the law is only based on an infectious agent of SARS-CoV-2, and we are working with Reiner Fulnick and Robert Kennedy, we all meet every week, the lawyers in the world, that the PCR sequencing evidence will be there as forensic evidence for court cases, and then we will be...
But the world, and that has already gone through, hasn't it, in terms of in Portugal there was a court case around the PCR testing.
Well, that's because the PCR case, but the thing is, you're actually going into that, you know, who's on the NEFID in Ireland, right, or the virology lab, and doctors. You would never, I worked in diagnostic tests for 20 years, you would never diagnose a patient based on a positive or negative. You would actually have to sequence it. So where it goes into the realms of procurement issues, right, because the governments are buying tests, but the virology labs, the science advisory committee, the prime minister is locking down the world, but for like a few hundred euros, you just sequence it, because there is a moral and ethical and medical issue that if the test is influenza or it's pneumonia or something else, if it comes out, the doctors have a duty of care and a medical negligence issue to actually properly diagnose. So you would never diagnose just based on positive or negative, but we will now provide the sequencing evidence. If it turns out they're not SARS-CoV-2, that will be used to end the lockdown because the law is only based on SARS-CoV-2. But of course, the doctors should be doing it themselves, right? It's actually based on the doctors. They should not be just doing a positive case. And neither should the virology labs, neither should the science advisory committees or the prime ministers. So there's a huge issue, I would say, for the prime ministers. There's also a procurement issue that if they are buying these tests, it looks like they are not diagnosing SARS-CoV-2. So whoever is ordering them in the departments of health around the world need to check this. And they're not going to do it, so we will do it. But we'll be ready then for the next pandemic. We'll just sequence it.
I think we need to get through this one first. I think, you know.
No, because the thing is, this is the eighth pandemic in 20 years,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's only a few people like me that if you see it as a pattern, and of course the real pattern is trying to undermine the rule of law, and undermine the medical profession and the rigor in science, as Ivor has ever been doing. So once you see that it's a mechanism to undermine our freedom, our economic, you know, ability, and the healthcare system and science, and undermine the rigor, there's no positive and negative control. There's no, you know, it's almost like the rigor that should be there in science has not been there. And I suppose people like me is definitely saying, once people realize that the how wrong it is to not have positive and negative controls, that any result should be sequenced and it should be said this number of cycles.
So when you talk about positive and negative controls, that's a way of testing the equipment to make sure that it's correct? Is that what you mean?
Well, I mean, so basically if you have a blank test with just the primers, if you over-cycle it, you'll get a positive, but it's got nothing to do. You could have it without a sample. But how you do that is, it would only cost 100 euros, is just send it to sequence and say, is it SARS-CoV-2? But of course, a lot of the error would be that it just amplifies up either human DNA or influenza. And once you sequence it, you go, you see, you cannot diagnose COVID-19 as a disease unless the causative agent is SARS-CoV-2. So there is a duty of care and a huge medical negligence issue that doctors need to send the PCR test for sequencing. And if it's not SARS-CoV-2, it's actually, they cannot diagnose it as COVID-19, and it costs about 80 euros.
And what about this whole issue of asymptomatic people then, in terms of from a medical point of view?
This industrial scale testing of the people who are perfectly well and telling everybody that they are infectious when they have no symptoms. We've never, ever in the history of medicine treated any condition like this before. It's absolutely bizarre. It's off the scale. You know, you cannot give somebody something you do not have. That's axiomatic, and that's the way we've always been. And now all of a sudden you have this, you know, massive treating and, first of all, quarantining of a healthy population, and then testing them with a test that we know that is up to, you know, at least 90% false positives, where there is low levels of infectivity.
So the thing is, can I just say, you're not actually tested, right? Doctors have a duty of care. So it actually rests with the doctor. So if they test to see is this SARS-CoV-2, the doctor has to sequence it. The doctor, the onus is on the doctor, cannot just take a test. And I'm not saying the doctors are being put in an invidious position, but actually the doctor actually rests with their indemnity insurance. Yeah. And so they need to say, and we will be happy to communicate it, we've been doing it, to that they can send it for sequencing, the doctor. And then if it comes back as SARS-CoV-2, but if it doesn't, they then have to maybe check it, you know, for influenza or if it's nothing to do with the virus. But of course, it's unethical on behalf of the doctors and the government to be sending people who are healthy, because then that's actually ordering tests that are not necessary. And so it's not just, it's actually inappropriate and it's a misuse of funds.
Absolutely,
and it has a financial issue for governments.
Yeah, so the world of medicine has been turned upside down. We were taught in college you treat the patient, not the test result. Whereas now you have a doctor at the end of a phone and you have somebody with a sniffle or somebody who's a close contact on the other end of the phone, and you send them for a test, and then that determines what happens to them. You know, and we don't have any contact. There's no laying on of hands. There's no, you know, proper history, you know, examination done. And it's broken the medical system. And I'm afraid it's breaking the trust between patients and doctors as well. And you know, just, you know, to go back to the science issue, it's not that hard for somebody to understand the idea of the cycle threshold if we were to get into that. And I don't want to make it too complicated.
Well, I think it's important, because I still hear people say to me, have you seen the number of cases? Have you seen the case numbers? Have you seen the case numbers? And this is, you know, what Eddie was saying, in terms of this just constant, you know, one-sided narrative that has just been over 12 months now, you know. So I think it is important to understand.
Well, I think I call it propaganda to give it a spark.
So absolutely, it is propaganda.
So people have to understand, cases do not equal sick people. You know, they're completely different, you know, and cases are driving the agenda here. But sick people, that's a different issue. But there was a lady who did a piece, a humorous piece, but it was very insightful. She told a friend she found a unicorn in a field because she found a little piece of a hoof, and she found a little piece of horse hair and a little piece of a horn. And she showed this to her friends, and she said, "There's a unicorn in there, you know." But this is what the PCR test is. You amplify things up enough, and you can get whatever you want out of it.
But that has been used to terrify. I mean, the psychological damage this has done to entire populations, and young children being told that they are some sort of an existential threat to their grandparents, and we are told that we are biohazards, we are walking disease spreaders, all of us, including people who have, you know, you don't have a sniffle. This is, you know, it's psychopathic. beyond belief. It really is.
When is that? When you're talking about the asymptomatic people and the pop-up centres, I came into contact with a woman in County Galway there a few months ago whose husband was recovered from cancer. He developed symptoms of cancer again in March 2020. He went to the hospital, couldn't get treatment or couldn't get tested. They said, you know, the pandemic, we need to wait. He went in again April, same thing, May, same thing, June, same thing. He was eventually tested in July, it had gone too far, and he died on, I think it was the 20th of December. So you can't get tested for diseases or conditions where you have symptoms,
yes,
but you can walk into a pop-up centre,
yes,
where you have no symptoms. Mm-hmm. There's something very, very wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
Get tested with a test which is worse than rubbish for a disease you don't have or which you can't give to anybody else to suit some sort of psychopathic agenda of these governments.
You keep cycling back though to the fact that what you're saying, of course, is medically accurate and it's scientific and all, but people aren't hearing this.
Of course not.
Because we don't have a fourth estate.
The media is the virus.
It's not there. We don't have a fourth estate. And therefore people aren't getting the information. And so long as people don't get the information, I'm talking purely about the Irish situation. The media is very vibrant in other countries. You know, you can see the difference between countries, right? So the people are they're thinking, they're looking, they're debating. Here we're just absorbing and you're not allowed debate because there isn't a fourth estate, and I can't stress it enough. That's the fundamental problem we've got for the last 12 months. A lack of journalism, a lack of investigative journalism that are prepared to stand up and take on what is being said, the orthodoxy, the technocracy, you know?
At the beginning of this, when I was still a politician, I used to write articles for the local papers, and I did write a few articles right at the beginning of this, laying it out as I thought, and talking about the harms of lockdown and talking about, you know, the tsunami of other illnesses that weren't being dealt with and how there was going to be a day of reckoning for all of this. And the Belfast newsletter, which would be known as the Wee Patterson paper, would have carried them maybe where other ones didn't. And I know my local paper, the Derry News, carried a few of them. And then all of a sudden it stopped. And it was just, since then, I've offered to debate the Minister for Health or anybody in any position of power and authority at any time, on any form of their choosing, about the whole sort of concept and the medical consequences, particularly of all of this. And the offer's still open if anybody's listening to me.
When you were saying, Eddie, though, about the media and everything being one-sided, something that I found very concerning, I think it was probably March, April, May of 2020, was when all of these different laws were coming out to do with the lockdown, especially around elderly people. I had so many people in their 70s and 80s asking me, if I go out into my front garden, am I going to be arrested? Because they thought cocooning was the law. Mm. And that was because of the way that the media, not necessarily the government, but the media were reporting it. They were suggesting that guidelines were law. And I always found that very, very concerning, that there seemed to be no separation between the state and the media.
Well, look, it's quite straightforward. In March last year, the main presenters of RTE would have been given their writing instructions about how this was going to be handled. And there's been journalism completely absent in RTE's machine around COVID-19 ever since. At the same time, Communicore, Dennis O'Brien, needed to sell News Talk. And he changed it from News Talk to Magazine Talk. And that's what happened. And I know, because I deal with the senior presenters in News Talk, I know exactly what was going on. So the Maverick voices were removed gently over time from the programme. So the one radio, like, we are an oral people. We're probably the greatest radio listeners in the world. We're highly intelligent at understanding what's right and what is accurate and what's inaccurate when we hear it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're an audio people. Unfortunately, News Talk walked off the pitch just at the wrong moment. Nothing to do with COVID-19, just to do with business decision. And we were left with a free run by RTE, which decides the news agenda in the bunker in the morning between around 4 o'clock in the morning, about 6. And then that goes out as the main, that sets the news agenda for the day. What it says in the newspapers is then brought up, and off we go. So for me then, looking at media, looking at journalism, and journalism is a profession I hold in the highest regard, by the way. So I'm very upset to see this happening. But journalism is really now down to local radio and local newspapers. That's what we've got. We have nothing happening on a national level. Nothing. And the strong investigative journalists that we've had over the years are either retired or they've been moved aside, and what we've got is what you see, nothing around this, which is why we're having this discussion, where we're having this discussion, in the manner we're having this discussion, because of the absence of the Fourth Estate in Ireland. This wouldn't happen in Finland, it wouldn't happen in Sweden, it wouldn't happen in a lot of the Nordic countries, and it wouldn't happen in many of the other European countries where there is some strength still left in the media. But unfortunately in Ireland there isn't.
A lot of people who were sort of on their own at the beginning of this, I mean, I heard Dolores talking, and it just blew my mind. I was going, I am not clinically insane. You know, when you were saying these things, and listening to Pat, I heard you in Dublin, I just going, oh my God. And Ivor, you know, I seriously was thinking, I thought I was losing it. And then I heard you people and I knew it was. No, I'm joking. It just, you have no idea how important it is to have that alternative voice. And sources like the Irish Inquirer, and, you know, there's hundreds of these independent radios and you know, people who are doing stuff. And it's been so important to bring people together and make people understand that this is real.
I think that one of the issues certainly that I would see is that there's a certain generation who, unless it's in mainstream media, it's not real. You know, there is that kind of embedded belief that, you know, unless it's on RTE at 6 o'clock, then everything else that's being said is rubbish. So I think that's quite, you know, how would you suggest as a group that we try to overcome that? Ivor, what are your thoughts?
Just in the media, I agree totally with Eddie. I mean, I just started calling RTE Pravda, middle of last year. I could not believe what I was seeing. So I've always, you know, I have a very strong sense of technical truth. I always got offended when the technical truth was twisted in my corporate career. Now, I've been a manager of people in large teams, so I know you have to manipulate certain facts. But technical truth, though, I don't like when it's twisted. And this thing has been a travesty. So almost every aspect is being misrepresented, technically. I mean, I just looking in front of me here, I pulled out the figures for RIP.ie and the CSO this morning, and they were sent to me, and I just redid the graphs. And I'm looking, and 2020, the only metric for a pandemic, really, is extra mortality in a year. Because the testing, the PCR, we've already covered. I won't cover it again. But if you look at 15, 16, 17, 18 in Ireland, 2020 is higher mortality with our big pandemic in April mainly than 15, 16 and 18. But it's lower mortality than 2017. And that's just a fact. Now, how many people in Ireland watching the media would realize 2017 had higher total mortality than 2020 with our pandemic? But that's just a basic fact, and it's in both the RIP.ie data, which tracks CSO, and it's in the CSO as well, and they all agree with each other. That's the tip of the iceberg. No one has a clue of any of the data around COVID because the media are 24 hours a day misrepresenting
the data. Well, you know, the case-demic. That term, came up, and to me, that's what blew my mind.
Yeah, the case-demic, and I don't think I made the term, but I popularized it. The case-demic for me was in a winter surge or in the April epidemic, right, the PCR approximately reflects what's going on with the virus.
People, I have no problem with the PCR.
So the PCR goes up and people die and ICUs are full. That's kind of an epidemic. But then all summer long, when you've got false positives dominating and your ICUs are empty, you know, and no one's really dying, that's a case-demic. And in 2009, with the swine flu debacle, they did that. In the UK, in the summer of 2010, they had a huge spike in PCR swine flu. But the deaths were the lowest summer in 10 years because it was a case-demic. Nothing was happening, but they were still getting positives. And then when we came into the winter resurgence in Ireland, you know, in December is when the virus triggered, and very complex triggering. Now, again, PCR sort of reflected what was happening, i.e. a lot of people got sick. But the case-demic is this massive gulf. And I'm going to be watching now because it's April. And it's going to be a case-demic now, maybe out till next October. But they don't want to let any of the lockdown go. I mean, the ICU collapsed in Ireland in February 2021. Is when the ICU figures curled over in a natural viral curve, right? The deaths were back going below baseline death by the start of March. We're now 2.5 months since the resurgence demonstrably had curled over and was gone down below what could be seen as serious. We're 2.5 months in lockdown level 5 since it effectively, de facto, ended. How much longer?
And as you keep pointing out, there are 30 published papers showing that lockdowns.
We have 37 now, actually.
37.
I've 37.
It's hard to keep up. It's every day, you know.
It's the spell. It's the spell that's been weaved by the psychological methods that are being used. And you can speak to this, Sarah, I think. And Dolores has mentioned it, that they've got better every time with each pandemic. They're refining this instrument. This time, they have the fourth estate completely nailed down. Yeah. And they have this fantastic trick of making everyone persistently aware of a pandemic by having people wearing masks and having yellow signs around the place and motorway signage and the ticker tape or whatever on the TV, constantly reminding you. So even if it's not accurate, doesn't reflect reality, if you tell it often enough, if you get it ingrains itself in your psyche. So that's it's more psychology than facts.
And obviously leading on from that is then the whole aspect of vaccines. So what are your thoughts on that? I'll go to you, Anne, about the vaccines.
Why would you vaccinate 7.8 billion people? The plan is to vaccinate everybody on the planet against a disease which is not a threat to the overwhelming majority of people. That, to me, that's just self-evident. Why would you do it? Why would you spend billions? Why would you put people at risk from adverse effects for something that is not going to harm them? You know, we know that under, Mike Eden talks about it beautifully, under the age of 60, he's a motorcyclist, you're more likely to die of a motorbike, even if you don't ride a motorbike, than you are of this problem causing you to depart this earth. The thing is, it's insane. It really is insane. Mathematically, it doesn't make any sense.
And obviously, Ivor, you've got the data in terms of the risks, you know, from COVID for the age groups. You know, so again, you know, what would you say then to that?
Well, yes. Yeah, so the real world risk in Ireland, just take Irish data, and all countries are different. They were hit in to different degree. So if you're under 70, it's around 1 in 7,000 risk. Right. And that includes both kind of epidemics, if you will, including the winter resurgence. So we're covering two full seasons and kind of 2 years as a result. Under 70, 1 in 7,000, which is pretty tiny. It's equivalent to the risk of dying from poisoning or noxious gas in the US, because I looked up the US tables. And then under 50 is around 1 in 50,000 in Ireland with Irish data. 1 in 50,000. And under 25 was around 1 in 250,000, quarter of a million. So, like, these risks for under 70 and certainly under 50 are tiny. And I don't think anyone, to our point about the media, realises that. They don't realise that 2017 had more deaths. And the flu season in 2017, and the graph in front of me, is shaped and sized almost exactly like April 2020 for COVID. So 2017, we didn't even talk about vaccines.
Yeah, but I think we've reached a point where almost facts don't matter at this stage.
That's the problem.
And really, people need to understand what's coming next. Mm. And for me, the two things that are a real cause of concern is what's going to happen around vaccine passports and what's going to happen with the information behind all of that and the processing of that, because anybody who understands the technology behind that is warning that there are very, very severe risks around vaccine passports, having your personal medical data hackable and usable for other purposes. We're already being pushed around the place by Facebook and Google and the algorithms there. We're talking about a new set of algorithms that are driving decisions around your mobility and your activity as a consequence of your medical profile. That's what we're talking about theoretically, unless there's pushback. And that's where I think there's going to be a substantial confrontation between those of liberal-minded people with civil rights versus what the plans are, not just technology company plans, but what the plans are around the, let's call it the technocracy, around how they would like to see the opportunity of the pandemic as a dry run for controlling the population and its mobility and its activity. And the access to that is medical information. And I'm just curious to know what the experts here think about that, because it's certainly a concern to me, and I'm only coming on it from a layman's perspective when it comes to vaccine passport.
But I think they're extremely important questions to ask. And Tracy, what in terms of the vaccine passport, you know, where are we at with that in terms of Ireland and Europe?
I think when we talk about vaccines or vaccine passports, there are two separate issues. So the first is the vaccine passport. We obviously know that legislation is going through the European Parliament at the minute. We know that at the start of April, the end of March, that there was a vote went through the European Parliament to accelerate the examination procedure for that legislation. We know that 468 MEPs voted in favour of accelerating, and what that actually means is that they don't really require a debate around the legislation. 203 MEPs voted against. In Ireland, we have 13 MEPs. 7 voted in favour, 6 against. All 7 are Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. That's the first thing to note. The second thing to note in relation to the vaccine passport is that the legislation to pass that through, that vote is due to take place on the 27th of April. So just whatever, 7-10 days time. When that goes through, because, and I'm sorry to be pessimistic about it, I do believe it will go through, even though we should still lobby our MEPs in that regard. But when that goes through, that will pass through as a regulation. What that means is that will be directly effective in Ireland. So I would expect that the vaccine passports will be up and running and operational maybe by June. So as it stands at the minute, the vaccine passports will only apply to travel. But we know with everything else, when a law comes in, it'll be used in other ways. So no more than when we saw in Ireland with the lockdown to begin with, the very first regulation that came out here, Statutory Instrument 121 of 2020, that was designed to lock the country down for 4 days, 4 days from the 8th to the 12th of April 2020. We're now at whatever, the middle of April, a year later, and we're still in lockdown. So when these vaccine passports come in, or if they come in, they will be used eventually in other forums, and that's probably going to be around businesses, shops, gyms. I would say it's far more likely that they'll come in initially in relation to things like concerts, outdoors, things that are considered non-essential. But once, you know, it becomes acceptable within society for people to have to show medical information in order to access goods and services, it's quite likely that it will come in other venues then too. So that's the first issue to be aware of. The second issue then is around mandatory vaccinations in the workplace. So I think we all saw that over the last number of weeks, I think it was around the 26th of March, that the HSE issued a notice to student nurses in placement years 1 to 3, telling them that they would no longer be able to proceed in their placements if they didn't get the vaccine. The reason they went after student nurses in year 1 to 3 is because they actually have no employment rights. If they went after student nurses in year 4, they would have had more employment rights. So that's the reason they targeted that particular group. We've a group of lawyers, there are maybe about 15 or 17 solicitors and barristers. We have been somewhat preparing for this over the last number of months. So between the 26th of March and the 8th of April, we secured a plaintiff student nurse. We secured the solicitor. We agreed the fees, and we actually started legal proceedings. So we had issued a pre-action notification letter on the 8th of April. We gave the HSE until the 12th of April to respond. They did respond on the 12th of April to us through their solicitor firm, and they also later that day issued a notification that student nurses would no longer be required to take the vaccination. An awful lot of people see that as a win. I'll be completely honest, I don't see it as a win. I see it as a strategic move by the HSE to sacrifice a pawn in order to save a king. So what we would have had there, we would have had a right to work challenge along with a right to bodily integrity argument all wrapped into one. And it would have been a very good case in terms of how it would have been perceived through the media by the general public, because they were targeting this very weak group of people. And when I say weak, I mean in terms of employment rights. So that wouldn't have played out well through the media. So what they decided was they would shelve that, and now we see that Statutory Instrument 168 of 2021 just came out there, I think it was on Sunday night, so the day before the HSE issued the updated notification saying the student nurses weren't going to be required to be vaccinated. The night before, they actually issued the Statutory Instrument, which has now separated vaccinated people and unvaccinated people in relation to gatherings in private dwellings for social purposes.
Sorry, Tracy, can I just not to interrupt your flow, just to bring it down to brass tacks so I understand it. Because I'm new to looking at this, and it does upset me. It terrifies me, to be honest, what's potentially possible out of it. Are you saying that the vaccine passport will pass through? You're telling me that that it's going to centre around travel, but the definition of travel is a bit hazy. it's not just inter-country travel, it's travel within a country, or travel to a local shop potentially? Or is that being defined under the law, or is it up to each individual country to decide what travel means at a specific point in time?
I suppose, first of all, I do believe the vaccine passport will go through. Second of all, it's only for international travel as matters stand, and that's obviously travel between the different European countries, so across borders. But I suppose the fear is, and we have seen it over the last 12 months, that when something is acceptable within society, the boundaries are pushed out even further. So, you know, it was like with the face masks. First of all, the face masks, it was only in public transport. Then it was, you know, only in certain shops. Then it was the banks and the credit unions were excluded. Then they were included.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that the precedent is the issue.
Exactly.
But then what about the data then, right? So if somebody has my medical data stored someplace in the cloud, there's arguments that blockchain can protect it, etc., which I don't accept, by the way. I don't want anybody with my medical data other than me. So where does the data end up?
I couldn't tell you. I don't think anybody could.
The reason why I ask is that the World Economic Forum has a project already up and running about medical data passports, the common passports. So it's already moved ahead of the EU. So it's going to be very interesting to see if the EU is going to become a barrier against the abuse of medical data on people's passports.
That's not the way it's looking. And I think Common Pass, yes, the Rockefeller Foundation, who I trust my future liberty and data with, and the World Economic Forum have got together for Common Pass, and their COVID Pass, a company was set up in March 2020, I think. I think a foreign jurisdiction kind of thing, a whole structure was set up. So even in March, before we even knew what this thing was about, COVID pass and other passes.
Well,
I think the intent is there.
But this has been highlighted for, you know, 10, 20 years. So this is actually nothing new at all.
And but how does it stop? How do we stop it?
So I think, I suppose, like, I have never worn a mask and I've never done anything. So all you have to recognise is that we have inalienable rights. So that, you know, you have inalienable rights of freedom of travel and bodily integrity. And what we see in the UK and Ireland is that they don't want these kind of cases to go to the higher courts. Because in our constitution, our rights of bodily integrity and freedom of travel are enshrined. And so we will be in the World Freedom Alliance, World Doctors Alliance, writing to the members of parliament, right, both of them, both ones that voted for this and against it, to inform them under notice of liability that there are huge adverse events, as we know, with a lot of these injections, and a lot of them have been withdrawn from use in various countries. So that if they vote for an injection, they actually can be held liable. If you are required for an injection, someone has to take the responsibility. So we will have a campaign with Children's Health Defence, the World Freedom Alliance, the World Doctors Alliance, to put them on a notice of liability that if they vote for an injection. So, for example, in one care home in Berlin, 8 people died. There was 31 elderly. 8 of them died after the first injection, and a further 11 died after the second injection. So 19 people died after, you know, out of 35. And in one Irish care home, 26 people died out of 51, right? So if the members of the European Parliament think that they can just vote, including the Irish, we will be putting them on notice of liability to inform them there is adverse events and that you cannot, because of your inalienable rights of bodily integrity, coerce someone into a medical intervention in order to, you know, exercise their inalienable rights of travel. So that they can be held after the notice of liability, we will inform them of the adverse events. So if the Irish MEPs, the 7, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, that anyone after the notice, we will put in an affidavit, that if you get an adverse event from a required rejection to, you know, exercise as an Irish national and passport holder, you know, to return to the state, that they can be held accountable in their personal capacity for the adverse events that they vote for.
Tracy, so, you just,
well,
sorry.
Can I just finish it off? That I think people, what's been happening in the last year is they have tried to infringe our inalienable rights of travel and freedom of speech, bodily integrity and privacy, and it's actually criminal and unlawful. And they've been, in a way, getting away with it because they have unlawfully closed the courts and the police, you know, there should have been an investigation if in 1 5-week period 26 elderly die in one care home. So we're in a society where, and this is a clinical trial, and 8 of those, we have the death certs, had dementia, at least 8. So because this injection is, you require full and informed consent. it is unlawful for the actual person, whether it's a doctor, if you inject someone that has dementia, they could not have given it. And unless when we check them up that their family give full informed consent, recognising the adverse events, because 26 of them died within 5 weeks, 19 within 2 weeks, right? So the thing is, that is from an injection. So if they think that they are going to require people to get that kind of injection in order to exercise their rights to travel where there's huge harm, those figures are not going to go away. So in a way, what it's uncovering is that doctors, sadly, have been injecting people without giving them the patient information leaflet for 20 years. The adverse events are around the chronic illnesses that are now increasing. You know, multiple sclerosis, juvenile arthritis, chronic fatigue. And if people were aware that those adverse events are related to the injection, they wouldn't take them. And sadly, this COVID-19 is now making it, you know, that people can actually talk about the significant adverse events. And it looks like the more prior injections you have, the worse outcome you have in adverse events. So if you've had 8 or 10 influenza, when you get this mRNA, you will have an immediate worst outcome. But it's known in the studies, which is what I alerted a year ago, is that if the next circulating, you know, agent is in it, there will be significant death. So in the animal studies, either half the animal died or all of them. And that people, we are highlighting it, the evidence is there. So if they think as members of parliament that people are going to have to be coerced into taking an injection where there's huge adverse events, those members of parliament and the doctors who still inject it to deliver those passports will be responsible if they don't inform people about the adverse events. So while it may look bleak now, you know, they will actually be held to account, because if there's huge illness and death,
there's
that cannot go on.
Urgency about this in terms of, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of people being subjected to what is essentially an experiment.
It's a clinical
trial. Technology, yeah. And it's not possible. No doctor can tell me you can get informed consent for something that is unlicensed, has emergency licensing, and there's no short-term data, much less medium or long-term data.
Well, there's
data.
A lot of data that deaths happened, yeah?
So we obviously could talk about this for a week, but we're going to have to wrap up now. And what I'd really like from each of you is, if people knew one thing that would help them to basically push back against this, you know, what would it be? Eddie, what would be your main sort of takeaway from this for people?
Well, I think, you know, from a financial perspective, I would say just be alert to the fact that all of the extra money printing that's gone on over the last 12 months or so, which is just jaw-dropping, is going to result in inflation. We haven't seen it from 1973 to 1983. You know, free markets were interfered with about 14 years ago. Central banks have just changed all that. So the whole financial system is in a state of flux, in a state of change at the moment. And I think you need to prepare for the likelihood that next year, maybe as early as the end of this year, certainly in the United States, consumer prices on the streets are going to start rising. We're already seeing it across the board in all commodities. Yes. And you need to prepare yourself for that.
This is coming.
This is coming. I believe you.
Ivor.
Yeah, I'd say, and I tend to harp on a bit, a few things. The actual real-world impact of SARS-CoV-2 and the ineffectiveness of the lockdowns and, by extension, masks. I think if people just got their heads around the data and understood that this impact is similar or within an envelope of a severe flu, and realised that the lockdowns didn't help much, may have flattened the curve a little, but not much. Realising that, you would see that passports, permits, you know, all the things that are happening have no basis just in justification. So I'm not too worried about the vaccine. I have some knowledge of the mRNA and the processes. I'm not worried actually about what it does or anything. I'm worried about the principle, more the legal principle, that for something within the envelope of a severe flu that would be unthinkable, right, a year and a half ago, to have this kind of infrastructure of passports is now being considered to be almost like obvious. It's insane.
Tracy.
I would say the majority of people aren't aware that on the 8th of April of this year, a judgment was handed down by the European Court of Human Rights, Vavrika. It was a Czech Republic judgment, and that was talking about mandatory vaccinations of children. People are probably not aware that there are maybe 11 European countries that already have mandatory vaccination laws in place for children specifically. there's a great deal of comparative material throughout case law within the EU that says that mandatory vaccinations is lawful in certain situations, and that basically individuals will have to give up their right to health in order for the betterment of the community, and in certain cases for the betterment of their children, where the state takes looks at the best interests of the child in place of the parents. What I would say in response to that is, even though I think the vaccine passports will pass through, people still have to lobby their MEPs. They have to lobby them relentlessly, because with MEPs and with TDs as well, and we know that the law on Part 3 of the Health Preservation Act, it has to be extended before the 9th of June. MEPs and TDs, all they're concerned about is sustainability. So all they're concerned about is re-election. So the people do actually have the power. So even though a lot of these things may pass through, if the government realises there's a significant amount of resistance to it, they will be concerned about re-election. So the people 100% have the power. They can turn this around. But we need thousands of them to actually write to their MEPs and write to their TDs and do it consistently. And don't take no for an answer, because they're there to serve the people, not to serve the EU, not to serve Brussels, and not to serve maybe third parties that none of us know the identity of.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you, Tracy. And
follow that. Yeah. You know, the thing about, I've been involved in politics with a very small p, and these people have no morality, none whatsoever, beyond the next election. So absolutely, what Tracy has said works. What I would say to ordinary people, I suppose, is you have power. You have integrity. You know more than these politicians. I mean, the level at which these people operate is stunning in its ineptitude. So that ordinary people reach out, talk, you know, reach out and make alliances with other people who have doubts. And I know that in the North we have built a rock solid group of really committed, incredibly talented and coherent individuals. I'm talking about young people, plumbers, hairdressers, you know, people who have just found one another. And we now have, Dolores was talking about the World Freedom Alliance. We have a Freedom Alliance on the island of Ireland, which will be organised in four provincial areas. Ulster, of course, are way ahead already. But people do have power. And we will put an end to this corruption and this destruction of our lives and our society and our culture and our children's futures.
Thanks, Anne. You did great following Tracy there, so well done. Pat?
Well, I think people should learn about their inalienable rights. They should learn what, you know, what freedom really means. Freedom is not about doing what you're allowed to do. We have these rights. Our ancestors fought for these rights.
Exactly.
You know, so it's our, we're only, Tracy said this a while ago as well, we're only one generation away from the extinction of freedom. And it's our time now. We need to take back our freedom.
Yeah. Thanks,
very good. Thank
you.
Very good.
And Dolores?
Yes, well, it was lovely, actually, because I set up the World Freedom Alliance, right? And so the idea is that we actually, no one can take away your rights, okay? So you actually, we have, and what inalienable means is from the minute you're born, you have them. And no one can take them away. And if you look at our beautiful Irish law and Irish constitution, is that something is only law. If an act is passed, it's only law if it actually is challenged, goes to the High Court, goes to the Supreme Court, is translated into Irish, is registered in the Supreme Court, right, and signed by the President. So, of course, that we think has not happened with a lot of these acts. So we have freedom of travel, we have freedom of bodily integrity, and no one can take them away. And so I totally am delighted with the Freedom Alliance and the Freedom Alliance in the United Kingdom and in the World Freedom Alliance. We have 100 countries. And it's really about the principle that we have, you know, freedom of travel, freedom of speech and bodily integrity. So just because something is mandated doesn't take them away. It's not mandated means in a republic it has to be voted for. We haven't voted for it. These will be challenged. We will take them. You can actually hold the individual Minister for Health to account and the President and Prime Minister, because they have signed into act. It's actually malfeasance. It's a crime. Malfeasance of public office is 10 years in prison, right? If as a President or Prime Minister, and it's actually treason for an Attorney General and the police to actually try and enforce an act that is potentially unconstitutional. And so a lot of these have not been challenged. But if we do the PCR test, see that it's not, so to give people hope, we will be sequencing the positive PCRs if they're not SARS-CoV-2. The government should have been doing that. They should have been checking, because the lockdown causes huge harm. If they didn't, the individual prime ministers and minister of health can be, small businesses can actually, they can be held personally to account, because they should have checked that it really was SARS-CoV-2 and if they're procuring tests. So I would have great hope that really we've been lied to for 30 years. A lot of the aspects of our society, the media is not working, the health system, you know, there are a lot of really good doctors, but they have actually not been allowed or not given treatment. They've been given injections without giving full and informed consent. And it's actually the doctor or the nurse is personally accountable for any harm in their private and personal capacity and in the indemnity insurance. The same thing, the guards and the judges I've interacted with have not answered, are you acting under oath? And so they are misrepresenting themselves as guards, right? And so what we've been saying is all you need is one guard, one judge, sadly one doctor, one principal. That
not
is
you, Pat.
Not you. No, but you say, you know, we know the masks cause harm, they're not necessary. So if you're a principal of a school and you actually are saying to children you must wear a mask, not informing them they don't have to, and that you can be held to account, and we just need one of those in Ireland, and it will happen, and they can be sued. So the guard, if they turn you around and you waste 50 euros of petrol, they will be precedence cases. And what we want is a society where people are accountable as men and women under the law. And that will happen. So we can use, in the good news, COVID-19 to expose a lot of the undermining of society and essentially corruption. And I do think the Freedom Alliance on the island of Ireland is an example that we want a grassroots movement that will actually change it. And then if people want to stand for election, and I would say the names of those seven European members of parliament, because I know we're doing it with Children's Health Defence, that we should just stand for election against those in 2 years' time and say, you know, there was deaths in the care homes, there's adverse events, yeah? So that's all, just to say, to give great hope, right? I think we really need to, that because once this Ireland works right, we will actually have a beautiful, you know, if people are accountable, if you have open debate, if the doctors can give safe treatments, and if the education system and businesses can actually function without the state infringing on our rights and over-regulating us, we'll live in
a Can I just maybe wrap it one last freedom, just in case we miss it, right? We have the freedom, and it's not a legal freedom, to turn off the television, turn off RTE. We have the freedom to break away from the groupthink. Yeah. We have the freedom to go on Google and to find out all this information for ourselves and not just to be listening to people like us. Go and find out yourself. And you have the freedom to sit down at your family, at your kitchen table, and start raising these items that are contrary to the groupthink and start using our brains. Because of all of the populations in the world that are capable of independent thought, we're at the top of the pile. And we need to break away, and that's the critical freedom.
Well done.
Thank you. Well, we have to wrap up. We have to wrap up here. Thank you so much. What an absolute honour to be sitting here with you guys. I actually feel quite emotional, to be honest, because this is the beginning of the end for those guys. And
yeah.
It's absolutely the beginning for us. So
we
thank
need
you very
to
much.
Stand in the truth, right? Enough
absolutely.
Of the lies. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Cool. Hey.